I am just going to try things out and see how they land in preparation for the big talk next week. So I'm really grateful for all of you being here. Just don't let this be the last talk of mine you'll ever see. Also, please ask me many questions, because if I don't know the answer today, then I'll figure it out by next week. That's the plan. Okay, so bubbles live fast and stick together. I'll explain what that means and why it's important. So this will constitute probably the biggest part of my thesis, you know, a year from now, maybe more. Okay. Hold on. Good. Okay, so I'll explain, first of all, what a vacuum decay is. I will really quickly explain how I get predictions, starting from this new numerical stochastic approach. And then I'll get to the fun part.
Recording in progress.
With plots and new results. So some of the stuff that I'm presenting, I've never presented before. So you're welcome. Very exciting. Okay. Oh yeah, this is an example of a Bose-Einstein condensate. Starts off in a false vacuum state. Oh boy. And then as time goes on, it starts decaying. It's just a preamble. This is in two dimensions. Okay. What is vacuum decay? Well, it happens in any field theory where you have a potential that has two non-degenerate minima. So your field starts off here in the false vacuum, right? And then because you're in quantum mechanics and you want to have the minimum energy possible, there is always a chance that you can tunnel through to the minimum, to the true vacuum. So it's just a matter of time of when that happens. Now, the way this happens, okay, well, you have this volume with the field that's initially in the false vacuum, and then at a point, x and t coordinates, you get just a bubble. Inside of it, there's the true vacuum state, outside of it, the false vacuum, and the transition region is called a wall. Relativistic first order phase transitions are pretty much ubiquitous in early universe cosmology. Inflation, baryogenesis. I say here stability of the Higgs vacuum, that has more to do with the future rather than early universe cosmology. We don't really know exactly what the potential of the Higgs is, but you know, there is clue that it could be itself today in a false vacuum state. Early universe gravitational waves. People say this is related to the electric phase transition. If you follow the standard model, that's by now a second order phase transition, but if you go beyond the standard model, it could be first order, and hence this will be relevant then. Okay, so what triggers vacuum decay? Well, the field is not a calm sea. It has fluctuations around the true vacuum state. You can describe it in QFT, using what is called the Euclidean instanton formalism. This is what people have been doing since the 70s, basically. And I will very briefly go over what that instanton formulation is. So it is, yeah, it interprets vacuum decay as a quantum tunneling phenomenon. So the maths is really analogous to non-relativistic quantum mechanics tunneling, where you have a potential barrier and then you do a bunch of approximations to see how that field might look like on either side of that potential barrier. And the main achievement of this framework is that it gives you a prediction for the decay rate. It doesn't describe the nucleation process. This is sort of like the penetration of the potential barrier. We don't know what's happening there, but it tells you what the field looks like outside. At the true vacuum and at the false vacuum, and what is the probability per unit volume to obtain a bubble. Right. Okay, pretty crucial. Euclidean instanton formalism works only to h bar order in the path integral. The equation of motion for the oh. So to get the solution for this bubble, you need to go to Euclidean space, and this is the equation of motion for the what is called the bounce. That's the solution that interpolates between the false vacuum at infinity and the true vacuum. Now, these are just boundary conditions. Here's the prediction for the decay rate from this formalism. And yeah, I think I've said everything I wanted to say here. Oh, and once you get your Euclidean solution, you can analytically continue. So time goes to IT, real time, and you obtain this Minkowski solution where your bubble at t equals zero, it has a finite radius from zero to whatever, okay? And then with velocity zero, it starts to expand at constant acceleration. That's a bubble of vacuum. Okay, there are problems with this Euclidean instanton formalism because you're using QFT to describe something that is non-equilibrium, non-perturbative. There was another one, non-everything. You have to make a lot of approximations, okay? Some of them are really disturbing. For example, that equation of motion that I showed you, it assumes full Euclidean symmetry. Fluctuations are supposed to be small, that's okay. Truncate details about nucleation, yes. So like I showed you in that Minkowski picture, the bubble was formed with a fixed finite radius, starting from zero. So you paste a solution that has essentially a classical size, because bubbles are classical, onto the quantum vacuum. We don't know what happens until then. Assumes bubbles that are formed at rest. So far, no one complained about that, but it turns out that's a mistake. Assume bubbles are uncorrelated. What that means is that they are formed sufficiently far apart from one another that, yeah, they don't interfere in the path integral.
So the symmetry is not a symmetry of the field theory?
It is, yes. It's a symmetry of the action, yeah. But
why? So if you're to impose, yeah, like why even say that you need to impose it on the bubbles?
To impose, sorry?
Why even say that you need to impose it on the bubbles specifically? It's all
So the way you obtain that solution for the bounce, you have your action, or you have whatever, quantum fluctuation. Now that is a quantum action. It's a path integral, right? You can say that any trajectory that allows the bubble to form should be taken into account. But instead, no, you do a Gaussian approximation and you only say that the path that minimizes the action is the true correct bubble nucleation event. Fluctuations around that saddle point solution are assumed to be really small. It's just standard QFT procedure. So you have your action.
I was referring to the second one.
Pardon? Yes. Yeah.
I was asking about the O-N symmetry.
Yeah, so the postulate is, and I don't think people have actually looked into this enough, the postulate is that the solution that minimizes the path integral has O-N symmetry. I don't know how much people have actually scanned the action to see whether this is true or not. O-N symmetry means that the bubble that is formed is spherical. Any perturbations are increasing the action, therefore the probability to form a bubble that is like slightly deformed is exponentially suppressed. So really large deformations are no, they don't happen in this formalism. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So for the O-N symmetry, N is the dimension of, is 4 and?
It's, yes, 4, 4 Euclidean, so.
I see. I guess the usual interpretation of Euclidean path integral is obtain it through some weak rotation of the Lorentzian K.
Yeah.
Obtain the Euclidean path integral. So I'm wondering, geometrically, if I assume an n-dimensional sphere for the bubble, what does it look like when I rotate back to the Lorentzian? What's the physical shape of the bubble in the Lorentzian case?
It is spherical in n minus 1 in the spatial dimensions here. And then in the time dimension, it expands with constant acceleration.
I see. So the symmetry reduction means it has a constant rate of expansion in time.
That's right, yeah.
In Lorentz. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, now... We know that all of these approximations are part of the Euclidean formalism. We just wanted to poke at it initially. And we need to look for clues from elsewhere. One of these places is peak theory, just classical peak theory for a Gaussian random field. Gaussian random fields are very nice because we know what their spectral moments look like to arbitrarily high order. So we can make analytical predictions of what this field would look like. And what, okay, here I'm just plotting a two-dimensional Gaussian random field. You see we have peaks and troughs, and here is that Gaussian field. And what I want you to notice is that these peaks, the taller they are, the more clustered they are. So if I have a really tall peak over there, I am a lot more likely to have a tall peak right next to it rather than at a certain distance away. And you can formalize this analytically using this analytical peak theory. This actually came about in the context of people trying to figure out the distribution of the large-scale structure in the universe. So if dark matter was this Gaussian random field, luminous matter, baryonic matter, is supposed to cluster at these the highest over densities where it forms galaxies and so on and so forth. And the idea here was to come up with a prediction for the correlation length between these dark matter halos and whether they follow the distribution of large-scale structure in the universe. Because two-point functions are a measurable, are an observable in an experiment. So, inspired by this discovery, okay, we wanted to see whether this would apply to our vacuum fluctuations. So we needed a new technique for this. That follows the real-time evolution of the fluctuations. This was developed by my advisor and his collaborators from UCL, Nottingham, and UFT. So this traces the evolution of a quantum state using the Wigner formalism. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I have a lot to cover, but basically, the evolution of this Wigner functional this Wigner functional is a probability density of your initial state, which is, in our case, the vacuum, right? And the evolution equation is essentially the analog, the stochastic analog for the Schrodinger equation. So to trace, to learn about a quantum theory at an arbitrarily, you know, late time, what you need to do is to create an ensemble with initial conditions drawn from that distribution. You time evolve it classically, and then to get observables, later on you just need to take the ensemble averages over all of your realizations. This is actually a really, this is the preferred interpretation of quantum mechanics used in cold matter experiments. So basically you have your little experiment, you have some gas in it, okay, you create this gas that you supercool, etc., and then you want to see how does the system evolve and what happens to it. Now, it's not enough to run a single experiment, because as soon as you measure that experiment and the quantumness of it disappears, you need to measure it at different times and then ensemble average over thousands and thousands of experiments. And that is how you make a prediction. So this is similar for us, but we do it numerically. Oh, one more slide. What I'm showing here, so this is our initial state. This is the evolution equation. Okay, to first order, you see, this is just a classical Hamilton equations of motion. If you want to trace it to arbitrarily high order, then you're going to take higher derivatives in your potential. A few things to note. The vacuum is a Gaussian state, right? So this is positive definite. Evolution is exact for quadratic potential. So if this potential doesn't have third derivatives or higher, then this the classical evolution is enough to analyze the full quantum mechanical evolution of your initial state. And then quantum effects of order h bar are already accounted for in this action, even if your potential is nonlinear, right? So you get rid of this term, the first term, classical evolution, that's enough to encompass one loop order corrections, well, one loop order effects. OK, so that's what we do. We take our quantum vacuum, which is sampled as a Gaussian state. We time evolve it classically on a lattice, and then see what happens. These are details about how we do actually do this implementation. So we initialize our field around this false vacuum state plus fluctuations. The momentum is actually initialized around zero plus fluctuations. And this is the statistics of a Klein-Gordon field on a lattice, discrete. And for any arbitrary potential, you can do the evolution and see what happens. Back to peak theory. I said you have an analytical prediction for what your two-point correlator for peaks should look like. At the same time, you have this other this framework, this numerical framework, where you can take a random Gaussian field, you can evolve it into a quadratic potential. There's just no interactions, just a potential well, quadratic, and come up with an estimator that samples independently of distribution. This estimator samples the peak-peak correlation function. So basically, you have a realization, one simulation, you have a bunch of peaks between inside it, and you detect all of these peaks, and then you measure what is the distance between them. You divide this by the number of peaks in that sample, and then ensemble average, like I said, to get your classical observable. And the match is in the plot. Okay, so the solid line or dotted line is the analytical prediction. The little circles are the lattice prediction. And they match pretty well. So we move on to looking at fluctuations inside this nonlinear potential that supports bubble nucleation. Here, I'm going to stop and talk about this for a moment. So here is an example of what a bubble looks like in simulations. Okay, so we're on a circle. This is the field amplitude on that slice. This is at fixed time. This is a snapshot of the field at a particular time across the lattice, okay? So we start off along this green slide, green line, and then if you trace the location of this little peak, first of all, it moves slightly, and then it grows as it goes. And this is, we identify this as a bubble nucleation. You see, it starts around pi here. It grows until it reaches this 2π state, which is the false vacuum, and it doesn't go back. Right. So it looks as if the bubbles are formed around peaks in this Gaussian field. Oh, I should say, around the vacuum, the initial state is strictly Gaussian. That's the vacuum. Now, because this potential is nonlinear, as the fluctuations grow to probe away from that quadratic minimum, then they start to interact and grow. They're no longer Gaussian modes that don't talk to each other. Right now, we have interactions between modes, and nonlinearities will grow, literally. OK. So if they form around peaks, do they actually cluster? The answer is yes. Again, I'm not going to talk about the detection procedure, but you can trust me that this is the case. So even with sufficiently large error bars to account for false detections, like this little orange peak over here, or I don't know, sometimes you detect the background fluctuations as bubbles, you get that indeed there is a clustering between bubble nucleation sites.
Can I see the darker spot?
Yeah, sure. Which one? The blue?
Yeah.
Dark blue. Oh, so the potential actually allows two types of vacuum bubbles to form. There's a vacuum centered at zero and a vacuum centered at two. Okay, so if we map again, same with peaks, we see how many bubbles we have in a simulation. We measure their exact location, space and time, and then we map the distance between them, normalized by how many there are, ensemble average, and you get this, you know, dirty curve over here. And this nicer curve is the analytical prediction. Qualitatively, they're the same. Obviously, this is obtained for a Gaussian field. This has a lot of weird stuff happening, nonlinearities. Qualitatively, they are the same. Some features, for example, this slope goes down as e to the minus mr, pretty much like any scalar correlator, where m is the mass of the field and r is just the separation. Another feature is up to, this is normalized if you see, to this length scale r, which is the size of the bubble. So basically no bubbles up to that size, where we expect the edge of r bubble to be, but then right afterwards, there is a peak here showing that it is more likely to form a bubble at this separation here in this theory 1.5 compared to farther away. Here I'm showing the correlation between bubbles of different size, so they're anti-correlated. If I have a bubble of vacuum 2 pi, then here that I'm actually less likely to have a bubble of vacuum zero. Close by, okay? This is why this is still negative up to large distances. And this is the, oh, this is the overall correlator. Okay, you can come up with a similar estimator in 1+1 dimensions. And here, this is a contour plot of the probability two of the correlation function. So if you're inside a bubble that was formed here, here is our past light cone, here is our future light cone. This is, of course, the Rindler spacetime. We see that this correlation function is really a 1+1 dimensional object. So I am more likely to live next to a bubble universe that is close to me than to have a neighboring bubble universe that is farther away. And here, why is this shinier? Well, because I'm choosing different potentials. So this lambda modulates the depth of the false vacuum well. If lambda is larger, then the false vacuum well is deeper. It is less likely to form a bubble because the potential barrier is just larger. So this correlation is stronger. Exactly, this is completely analogous to classical peak theory. Very quickly, another exciting result that we wanted to, that we, you know, came across while looking at this. We noticed that the bubbles are nucleated with non-zero center of mass velocity. There is no possible way to make a prediction for this, starting for the vacuum case, because the vacuum bubbles have zero energy. So it is meaningless to say that you boost a bubble that has zero energy to a different frame. But you can make a prediction for the thermal bubble case. The thermal case means that the population follows the Bose-Einstein distribution. The potential is actually, the potential I'm evolving in numerically is the same as before, but this is just for illustration. So the energy levels inside this false vacuum well follow that distribution law, and we model this numerically with a field that has this shape on the lattice. The decay rate for this vacuum is proportional to the Boltzmann factor. So basically our fluctuations need to have an energy that is of order the height of the potential well. Okay, so if that is the minimum energy that I need to overcome this barrier for a thermal field, then I can shift, if I have slightly more energy, it is what will happen physically is that I will have a bubble that forms, and then after it forms, it still has enough energy to start moving. Okay, so our prediction for the distribution of velocities in a Gaussian approximation actually has this shape here. So minimum energy, and these are Lorentz, this is a Lorentz factor that accounts for deviations in that minimum energy that go into translating the bubble, the center of mass of the bubble. So as an example, which is not great, we have this bubble here. This is the original, how it shows up in simulations. I should have chosen a better bubble. Basically, at the nucleation location, You see, I have, instead of a bubble that is at rest, the trajectory of the bubble walls actually follows hyperbole. So this wall, this bubble is moving to the, is this left? Left. So it travels at some velocity. It starts to expand with constant acceleration until it reaches the C velocity. The other bubble wall traveling to the right is traveling against the center of mass velocity. So it has to, you know, it follows a hyperbola. And if I apply a Lorentz transformation on the grid, then I can bring it to rest. That's just distortion due to the boosting and interpolation. And this is my new final bubble. Do you guys want me to finish or should I keep going? Okay, I'll just very quickly talk through the rest of this. Okay, so we have the prediction that depends for the spread of velocities that depends on the temperature, right? We measured it for three different temperatures. I don't know if you can see, this dotted dashed line is the prediction. It's literally that. And then the stuff with the error bars is my empirical, my experimental data for the velocity dispersion relation. And okay, it's not perfect, but it definitely follows the right trend and it's pretty good still. This, by the way, is new. The prediction was right there, but no one actually came up with it. In fact, in the literature, when people do baryogenesis simulations, they all assume that the bubbles are formed at rest and then the walls expand with constant acceleration. So in the late time regime, when the bubble is already highly relativistic, there's no difference between these two frameworks. But at the very moment of the nucleation, if you have a center of mass velocity, that is completely going to change the prediction. So the expansion history of the bubble can be quite important. Okay, so you've brought all of your bubbles to rest. Now you can stack them, that's average them. And they look the same. Three different temperatures, exactly the same bubble. Which makes sense, because the shape of the bubble itself should only depend on your potential. It does not depend on the initial conditions. It is a classical object. It forgets about the, you know, details of the false vacuum field theory. And here I'm just comparing against that bounce solution. Remember, if you take that O-N symmetric equation of motion, you can solve numerically for that bounce. And you get that fill line. You see the average from simulation is actually pretty close to it. If you take the same critical bounce but obtained experimentally, the dash dotted line, and you throw it into the simulations, what you see is that you obtain the expanding solution. That's a bubble. Now, if you take this dash dotted line and you deform it slightly, just a little bit, like, anyway, you get this, this is no longer a bubble solution. This is bound in the sense that it has negative energy compared to the free fluctuations of the field, but it is not an expanding solution. So this really shows us that experimentally we obtain exactly the critical solution that interpolates, remember, between the true vacuum and the false vacuum. Good. The really neat trick here that I really like is that if you have your average bubble, if you invert the equations of motion numerically, very easy, you can reconstruct the potential that your field is in. Okay? So if your field has, say, this equation of motion, it only depends on what? The momentum which you have, because you see exactly how phi depends on t. You just take a derivative numerically. You can invert this to get the potential. There are two regimes you need to look at. The bounce, which is just this critical slice here. Okay, so you take phi of x to obtain the bit that is up to here, that's the bounce. Now to go inside the true vacuum well, you need to take you need to analytically continue, right? You do a flip to imaginary time. Now you are inside the bubble, so you get phi of t, which has this equation of motion, and you can reconstruct the potential inside the bubble. Why is this important, you may ask? because you get a lot of renormalization effects. One type of renormalization is due to being on a lattice, so the UV and the IR, they talk to each other. They change the effective potential that the field is in. The other one is because you have a temperature. Now, I've chosen these temperatures in such a way that they don't really deform the potential. Too bad, but you know, in principle, you can capture any sort of cumulative effect so that the field you're looking, the field obviously it knows, it senses all of these effects that deform the potential. This is a way to recover it empirically rather than with, you know, analytically with approximations. People don't even know how to do that because, okay, you know how renormalization works around the false vacuum where it's quadratic and whatever. But no one has done non-perturbative renormalization when they see, oh, how does evolution here affect, you know, the potential that far out? This is a way to recover that. Vacuum bubbles, they're far more relativistic. That's an original bubble. This is the Lorentz deboosted bubble. You see it's very distorted. It goes from big to small or small to big. That's like Lorentz contraction, but inverse. You stack these together, you take the distribution of velocities. Now you see that the most likely configuration for the vacuum bubble is actually to be fully relativistic. It's massless. It expands, sorry, it travels at the speed of light. Very different from the thermal distribution. We don't know how to get this prediction analytically. So if you have any ideas, please send me an email. If you compare the vacuum bubble with the thermal bubble, the field looks the same, but there is a lot more momentum. And I need more bubbles to deboost so I can get rid of those fluctuations there. Okay, this doesn't matter. Oh, and in fact, the critical bounce, that the slice that evolves into the expanding solution for the vacuum case actually looks exactly like the thermal case, and that is concerning. They should be different. They should look like this. So if you solve that potential, if you solve for the bounce from the potential that this is evolved in, you should get this analytical solution. Remember, for the thermal case, there was a perfect overlap. But for the vacuum case, we're really far away. So there is something a bit off with that quantum mechanical, with the Euclidean instanton formalism. But it requires further investigation. And that's it. So we proved that these bubbles, they actually follow some of the statistics of the underlying density field. If you were to measure the correlation function experimentally between bubble nucleation sites, you could infer what was the statistics of the underlying field back in the false vacuum. That's a pretty powerful tool. And the other thing we showed is that the nucleation of the bubble actually pops the Lorentz invariance of the field, and that at nucleation they have non-zero center of mass velocity. They are nucleated with more energy than what was predicted so far. Okay, thank you for listening. Sorry, I went over time.
Is there still time to ask questions?
Sure. If you wish, we can go downstairs to talk. I'll just stay here to answer questions. Sorry, I went over time again. But yes, I'm listening.
Yeah, okay. I wonder how you model quantum measurements in your algorithm. I think you introduced this around the slides of Wigner functions. And you said you have to run a lot of samples. So for your quantum measurement, do you pick out a time stochastically?
Can you repeat the last question?
Yes. For modeling quantum measurements,
yeah.
When do you apply the measurement? Do you pick out the time stochastically?
Okay, so what happened? So you have this probability distribution, underlying probability distribution. In our case, it's Gaussian because we want to model the vacuum. As soon as you've drawn the initial conditions for the field, it is basically like a measurement process. You've collapsed the wave function because from then onwards, the evolution is deterministic.
You draw a particular value for phi and pi. at the initial time?
Yes, so at t equals zero, you draw the initial state of the field and of the momentum. And with that, you just get, from then onwards, it's deterministic.
I see. Then the evolution is a classical evolution plus a quantum, right?
The quantumness, if you want, up to order h bar, is in, inside the initial state. Again, so all of the, these predictions I'm making, similarly to the Euclidean instanton formalism, they're only valid up to one loop order. But the two frameworks should be the same. Sorry, the two, this, you know, Wigner formalism is essentially like Schrodinger equation.
It's like at the initial time you make a quantum measurement and then you perform a quantum measurement update.
Yes.
And then from there on, the evolution, it is still quantum up to one loop order.
That's right.
That's what you're saying. Let's see. Okay, so physically, I think of the universe, this measurement, you're assuming that some measurement takes place in the early universe or not, or at present.
The analogy there, I don't know. I guess as soon as the universe was formed, you know, it was formed with some initial conditions, and those gave you the, I don't know, underlying distribution of your inflaton, if you wish. And but since then, if you want to make the analogy, since then the evolution has been deterministic. The role of
right, but that you have to assume this, some measurement to take place in the early universe.
I see. Well,
It seems more reasonable. I mean, depends on your view of quantum interpretation. It seems more reasonable to me. The measurement takes place now, and then maybe I want to evolve backwards.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to think about that. But yes, I see what you're saying.
I see. But but it's not very nice to see the results in the numerics. I like the plots a lot. Thanks for the talk.
Thank you. Anything else? OK, well, thank you.